Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It was Fight Night 2 in Detroit last night as 10 more Democratic presidential candidates took to the debate stage. The main target of the night was frontrunner Joe Biden, with Democrats directing attacks not only at the former vice president, but also at the policies of former President Barack Obama, especially the nearly 800,000 deportations that took place during his administration.
To compare him to Donald Trump, I think, is absolutely bizarre.
So did you say those deportations were a good idea? Or did you go to the president and say, this is a mistake, we shouldn't do it? Which one?
I was vice president. I am not the president. I keep my recommendation to him in private.
Mr. Vice President, you can't have it both ways. You invoke President Obama more than anybody in this campaign. You can't do it when it's convenient, right, and then dodge it when it's not.
So back to help us analyze the second night is Michael Capuano, former Massachusetts congressman and now the public affairs director for Foley and Lardner. Congressman, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Also with us again is Mariama White-Hammond. She's a pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester and an activist and organizer. Reverend Mariama, welcome back to you as well.
Great to see you again.
And for another perspective, we have Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom joins us via Skype. Tom, hello there.
Good to be back with you.
And we want to hear from you on this. What were your major takeaways from last night's debate? Did you learn anything new? Did the candidates do damage, or did they advance the party's cause with the arguments they had? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So I want to start with the two Democrats on our panel. What were your reactions? Congressman, jump right in.
Again, interesting. It was pretty much what I think most people expected, the Joe Biden defense couple of hours. But I actually think he acquitted himself well. I think he did last night what Bernie Sanders had done the night before. There were questions about whether they could stand up to it all. I think they both answered the bell, and I think their supporters should be happy with that. But I also don't think anybody lost. I think others did well. I think Cory Booker did well. I think Tulsi Gabbard did particularly well, and I think the only person who might have walked out of there a little bit hurt might have been Kamala Harris. And not for any other reason than Tulsi Gabbard took her on an issue that I had not heard about before. I don't know much about the senator's time as attorney general, I don't really understand all of the comments that were made last night, but I think it raises some questions that people are going to have to answer now.
Well, let's jump right in with some sound. We have that clip where Tulsi Gabbard took on Kamala Harris, so let's go ahead and listen to it.
She put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana. She blocked evidence. That would have freed an innocent man from death row until the courts forced her to do so. She kept people in prison beyond their sentences to use them as cheap labor for the state of California.
So, Reverend Mariama, that was a striking moment last night. Mm-hmm. Somebody really pushing hard on Kamala Harris, where she'd been the one pushing mm-hmm. the previous mm-hmm. time around. Were there other big or striking moments to you in last night's debate?
Well, I thought that was definitely one. It was one of those things where I said, oh, well, now I need to go back and Google this and figure out what's going on. And so I do think Kamala Harris really needs to come out strongly and explain those things. I also thought it was interesting when Joe Biden attacked Cory Booker and his policing record, which I happen to know quite a bit about. I actually thought that Joe Biden was bringing up something valid, but I don't think he did the greatest job in terms of following through. I think in the end, from a debate perspective, Cory Booker came out on top because he was better at sort of responding to it, and Biden sort of lost track of his facts. But I do think that if people look it up, they're going to find, I am somewhat familiar with that, that Joe Biden's original assertion is not altogether wrong. Well, early on, he did do a sort of tough-on-crime thing that he had to backtrack from.
Let's listen to that. We've actually got that piece, too.
You engaged in stop and frisk. You had 75% of those stops reviewed as illegal. You found yourself in the situation where three times as many African-American kids were caught in that chain and caught up. The Justice Department came after you for saying you were engaging in behavior that was inappropriate. And then, in fact, nothing happened the entire time you were mayor.
All right, so let's put some context around this. This was in a back and forth. Well, go ahead.
So the nothing happened part was where he actually fell off. He should have just left that off.
And why was he pushing on Booker?
So I think the reality is in the early days, Cory Booker, when he was elected, and I think this is a complexity that we don't always get to. The reality is that there are also people in black communities who want a tougher, push. They think that, like, having kids hang out, there are people that believe in the broken window theory that, you know, if you don't clean it all up right away, then it's not going to come back together. And I do believe that early on, Cory Booker sort of capitulated to that way of thinking. What I think is also true is that after all the heat came down, it came down on him. It also pushed back on some of those folks who were supporting him. And then they did do a big shift. So if he had left it at that and just said about the first 2 years, then I think he would have been in a better place. And what actually I thought was the real opportunity for Biden, which he never did, was to admit that people grow. That you can start in a certain place, you can make mistakes, you can get called out on them, and then you can make a decision that you want to go in a different direction, which is what Cory Booker did. I actually think that's to some extent what Joe Biden has done in some instances, but he never will admit it. So it's like, just say, you're right. 30 years ago, I was in one place. I've learned, I've grown, I've seen some things. This is what changed my perspective. And then just move on. But by trying to dig in and hold on certain kinds of things, I think he just makes it worse. So I think he could have, I was waiting to see if he might flip it again and say, you've learned, you've grown, just like I have. That's not what happened.
So, listeners, have you seen anyone grow in the last couple of debates? We've been watching a lot of people talk already for a long time. So have you seen anyone grow, anyone change, anyone admit mistakes? It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Call us. Congressman, I'm going to come to you, and then I want to get to Tom Nichols right after that. But here was what started this exchange between Biden and Booker. And this is Booker talking about Joe Biden's history with crime and crime legislation.
Mr. Vice President has said that since the 1970s, every major crime bill, major and minor, has had his name on it. And sir, those are your words, not mine. And this is one of those instances where the House was set on fire and you claimed responsibility for those laws. And you can't just now come out with a plan to put out that fire.
Congressman, what did you make of that larger exchange?
It's the argument that's been made for a few weeks now. And again, I think America has changed. Look, I was mayor when some of these bills were passed, and I have never voted for a single minimum mandatory sentence. I hate them. I've always hated them. That doesn't mean I'm soft on crime. It means I know the difference between some people committing one act and another person committing the same act and maybe getting a different sentence. That's all that is. At the same time, look, America was not in that place. America wasn't a place where everybody should be thrown in jail for everything for a long time. The whole country was. Now, again, I actually think everything Mariama just said was 100% right. I'm a little bit less sanguine on somebody actually being able to do that in a debate like last night. I don't think that's the forum you can actually do it. But people do change. They do grow. I grow. You grow. We all do. Because you have different experiences in life. Something changes. All of a sudden, you try something. Mm-hmm. And I'd say criminal justice is a classic example. A lot of people tried tough on crime the way they define it today, and a lot of people have now come to the conclusion, lots of America has come to the conclusion, maybe it didn't work out quite the way we thought, and now we need to change it. That is normal, that is good, and politicians are not exempt from that. And I don't think it's just Joe Biden. I dare say probably everybody on that stage has changed their mind about something. And it's human nature. So, yes, I think it's
I'd be concerned about them if they weren't. I mean, as a pastor, my hope is if you're coming to church every Sunday, that next year you're not in the same place that you are this year. Yeah. That is the whole point of what we're trying to do. So I'm not always clear why people have such a hard time saying, you're right, I got caught up in a fervor. This is what I believed could work. And we learned the lesson, and I learned the lesson, and I'm ready to move forward. Just say that and move on.
So Tom Nichols is on Skype with us. He's joined us. And Tom, I want to turn to you, and I want to ask you, there was a lot of litigating past history in the debate last night. A lot of people talking to other people or accusing or condemning other people for past choices, behaviors, strategies, et cetera.
Some stuff before most people were born.
Yeah. Is that... I got to just ask you, Tom, from your perspective as a non-member of the Democratic Party, is that a good idea?
Not only no, but hell no. And, as Mike Capuano, I'm sure, knows as an experienced politician, in politics, if you're explaining or apologizing, you're losing. There will be no end to it. I mean, I really, without having a kind of dog in this fight for 30 years, I was really disheartened to see people like Bill de Blasio, of all people, sort of thumping the podium and demanding these ritual self-denunciations from Joe Biden or Cory Booker trying to, paint Barack Obama, both Cory Booker and Kamala Harris trying to depict Barack Obama's vice president as some kind of crypto racist. To me, that just all struck me as insane. And I couldn't, you wouldn't be able to blame someone if they walked away from that debate saying, boy, I guess the only thing I really learned is I should never have voted for a Barack Obama and Joe Biden that first time around. I had no idea they were so bad.
I also particularly did not like the attack on what did you tell the president? What did you advise the president? Especially
absolutely.
From where it came from. They should know better. Those discussions must be private.
Exactly. I worked for a U.S. senator. If someone said to me, well, what did you tell the senator? Hey, those are – first of all, a vice president would never say those things, and de Blasio knows better. But even a staffer, anybody who's been in a confidential discussion with a politician would never – reveal those conversations. And everybody on that stage knew it. It was a really cheap attack, in my opinion.
I guess the problem, though, is you can't get all the glowingness and none of the baggage. And that's I thought that's where it was. So if you don't want to go there.
They all try.
No, I know. If you don't want to go there, then just generally don't go there. But I think that was a valid point to say you can't take. So hang on just a second,
because I just want to make sure our listeners remember that we want them in this conversation, too, especially on this. Do you apologize? Are you growing or are you losing? I find this apology thing very interesting. So call us. Let us know what you think. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom, jump right back in.
Sure. Look, a career in politics is not an exercise in self-actualization. I think it's okay for Joe Biden to say, look, I was next to the president when he made a lot of decisions. Some of them you're not going to like. Some of them you liked. I was there. I worked with him. I did the best I could to get his agenda through. As for my personal differences with him, that's what they are, personal. And I'm not going to talk about that. And again, everybody on that stage was a seasoned politician. They knew better than that. I actually think if I were advising Joe Biden or anybody on that stage, I would say never give in to this kind of ritual, this demand for a ritual of self-negation, because once you do it once, you'll have to do it again and again and again. And that's why people do that in a debate, because they're trying to lead you into an hour of explaining why you were always wrong about everything. So, and I think it was good that Biden didn't take the bait.
I think Julian Castro actually sort of summarized this and took this stab. Let's listen to what he had to say about learning your lessons.
First of all, Mr. Vice President, it looks like one of us has learned the lessons of the past and one of us hasn't.
Now, that was in a different context, but it actually makes me think about this ongoing discussion we've been having about healthcare, believe it or not, because there's been so much litigating of what have we learned from Obamacare and does it mean we should be carrying it forward or we should be doing something different? And once again last night, healthcare was one of the most substantive and contested policy subjects in the debate. And, we've talked about it after every single one. The issues are the same. But are we gaining any understanding or are we beginning to develop any kind of consensus as a voting population across America about what needs to happen with healthcare?
So I think the challenge is this. To really, really have this conversation in a substantive way, we have to get into the weeds. And the weeds are not helpful in a debate. One thing I do want to correct, because I got tweets about it and a Canadian friend of mine, is that even here on this program, this whole Canadians spend 50% of their money, give 50% of their money to the government and wait in line. I had a Canadian friend who said to me, could you please stop telling Americans to say stop saying that because it's just not true.
So, out there, Canadian listeners, we stand correct.
Right. So I think the reality is, and I think I go back a little bit to what we said, like, the truth is, what we know right now is the system we have isn't working. We don't 100% know what a new system will look like. It will have bumps. It will have cracks. And the question is, do we really want a new system? And how far are we willing to go to test it? And I think the problem is that they end up getting into the weeds in a way, in a format that's just not really meant for that level of detail.
There was a lot more detail about healthcare last night. Let's listen to when Kamala Harris was criticizing the Affordable Care Act.
Your plan does not cover everyone in America. By your staffs and your own definition, 10 million people, as many as 10 million people, will not have access to healthcare. And in 2019 in America, for a Democrat to be running for president with a plan that does not cover everyone, I think is without excuse.
Biden pushed back and said, yeah, but your plan, Harris, is going to cost us $1 billion. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Anytime someone tells you you're going to get something good in 10 years, you should wonder why it takes 10 years. If you notice, there's no talk about the fact that the plan in 10 years will cost $3 trillion.
So he also obviously was talking about the lag in implementation. Congressman, before I take a couple calls, is there any way to do this without spending significantly more money than the U.S. government is spending now?
It depends how you measure that. The answer is no. But at the same time, then that doesn't take account for the other side of the ledger, which is the savings on health insurance that you might be able to do. So you really should look. And it's a difficult conversation. And honestly, right now, the health care debate we're having, at least the average person on the street, the ones I hear from, it's really about very simple thing. Do I want to lose my private health insurance? It's kind of boiled down to that. And it's unfortunate, but that's where it is. And that is an important aspect. I mean, last night, for instance, I actually think Joe Biden said, and again, I don't know whether what accusations are right or not. Mm-hmm. So I will take for the moment as a presumption of truth that his plan would leave 10 million people mm-hmm. behind. And I don't know if it does, but let's assume it does. I would have, if it had been me, and again, it's always easier to do Monday morning quarterback, I would have said, well, that may be true, but you're going to take, you know, the health insurance that 150 million people like and change it. And personally, I went through the healthcare debate. And for me, I kept telling all my Democratic friends, we're making a mistake by only focusing on the 15% of the people who do not have health insurance. We are not talking about the 85% of people who do. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try to get the 15%. It means we owe an explanation, a clear, simple explanation to the 85% who do, who will be asked to do a little bit more to take care of that 15%. I think most people want to do that, but you have to explain it. We never talked about it. As a matter of fact, and then we get the bejesus beat out of us because, as it turns out, that some people were not able to keep the health insurance that they liked, mm-hmm. and it looked like we had misled them and all those kinds of things. I think all of that is a mistake, and this shorthanded argument about health care is doomed to be difficult, painful, yet unfortunately necessary.
This is a great time to take some calls. So Henry from Manchester, Massachusetts, thanks for calling. What did you find yourself thinking about last night's debate?
Hi, I just wanted to say that I agree with the Reverend. As a younger voter, it's really important, especially for older politicians, for them to be willing to show some vulnerability and admit that they're not right all the time, that they have room to grow if they're looking to sort of win us younger voters over.
Henry, thanks for that. I'm going to take one more call. We've got Jake from Kenmore Square. Jake, thanks for calling in. Share your thoughts.
So I'm curious about the healthcare issue, and why do the politicians focus so much on the healthcare rather than the incredibly expensive costs of operations and pharmaceuticals in this country that have largely been driven through legislation?
Thanks for that, Jake. And I'm actually going to take your question and turn it to Tom Nichols. Tom, with us over Skype. You know, several candidates did say, wait, we're focusing on the wrong thing in healthcare, mm-hmm. big pharma. There was a lot of attacks on corporations last night. What did you think of that? And is that something that you think a successful Democratic candidate should be talking about more of or less than?
It was another moment that bewildered me because, to me, the Democratic primary so far is a series of needless self-inflicted wounds on really explosive topics in an election that is completely winnable if it's run as a referendum on Donald Trump. The person who got away unscathed last night was not Joe Biden or Kamala Harris. It was Donald Trump. There were a couple of glancing blows off of him because they don't like him. But any time that the Democrats are talking about taking down corporations, taxing the hell out of corporations, going after big pharma, you know, as Congressman Capuano just pointed out, there are people with health insurance who are saying, but wait, what are you saying? Because we've already had this problem once where you told us we could keep a doctor, we could keep a plan, and then we couldn't. And it seems to me that the people on the edges of the debate who have no chance of winning. I mean, it's easy for, you know, Castro or de Blasio or Gabbard to score cheap hits. But the people that actually have to go out and eventually are going to be somebody out of maybe four or five people that are going to win this are going to have to explain everything that happened in that primary. And so, you know, these are all perfectly legitimate things to talk about, but, it, you know, there's a danger. I guess I felt coming from, and I remember I don't represent the government here. I'm speaking as a never Trump guy. it struck me that Donald Trump was getting away rather easily, because any Democrat on that stage is going to be better on health care than Donald Trump. And that really should have been the argument. And instead, once again, as I said right at the outset, you could almost walk away from that debate saying, boy, Obamacare, what a mess. What kind of idiot would have passed that plan?
So, Tom, to your point, so Cory Booker actually tried to make this point in the debate last night. Let's listen to that.
Well, first of all, let me just say that the person that's enjoying this debate most right now is Donald Trump, as we pit Democrats against each other while he is working right now to take away Americans' health care.
So, Reverend Mariama, was he the winner in last night's debate?
So I think that the truth is Cory Booker came out strongest in the debate in terms of sort of getting his point out there and not taking too many hits. I mean, I think that one thing I just want to note is this kind of like these unrealistic candidates. I just want to say, as someone who worked on the Obama campaign very early on, he was one of the unrealistic candidates that people were telling me about. So I just think we want to be careful about.
You pointed that out.
I have worked almost all on unrealistic candidate campaigns that are, many of whom are sitting in office. So I think wanting to remember, though, I think one of the other questions is that the Hillary strategy was, I'm so much better than Donald Trump. I'm so much better than Donald Trump. And she didn't win. So I think we should be slightly careful about thinking that just focusing on Donald Trump will be enough, because that actually, I don't think, will energize enough people. I think that it's fine to pivot in that direction once somebody's up against Donald Trump, but her whole strategy was, look at that idiot, here's me, and she still lost. So I just think, not the popular vote, but the electoral college. So I'm a little wary of that strategy, given that it didn't work.
So sit back down at the table with us and have a conversation. Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let us know what you think a winning strategy might be. Tom Nichols, you wanted to add something to that. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. First of all, Reverend, I don't want to engage a reverend in games of chance, but I'll put a lot of money down on either of our favorite charities that neither Tulsi Gabbard nor Bill de Blasio is going to be the president of the United States. I think that there are people. I don't think Obama was nearly that much a long shot. And I also would argue Hillary Clinton had unique problems as a candidate. It was not because of her policy positions. It was not because she merely ran as the anti-Trump. There was a whole perfect storm of problems there that are really part of her campaign and the baggage that she brought to a Democratic campaign. I really think in 2020, you can run, particularly with women and people of color. Women are going to abandon Donald Trump if they have any room to do it. My biggest concern is that the primaries will produce a candidate where a lot of people in the four or five states are going to elect the president, because nobody, I don't mean to say this dismissively, but nobody cares about California or New York or Massachusetts. We know how that vote's going
to
go.
It's hard not to sound dismissive, Tom.
Well, sorry, it's just, but it's the truth. I mean, there is no mystery about the outcome of the election in New York or where I live in Rhode Island. I mean, it's just not a mystery. It's not, Rhode Island is not up for grabs in 2020. And so you don't want to have the primaries create a candidate where people say, well, I really hate and fear Donald Trump, but he's the devil I know, and I'm either going to vote for him again, or I'm just going to stay home, which I think is actually the bigger problem. And I'm always worried when Democrats use the word energize. If Donald Trump is not reason enough to be energized and enthusiastic to vote, then the Democrats have a massive problem that no primary and no policy can solve.
Okay, I'm going to grab a couple more calls. Eric from Worcester, you're on the line. Tell us what's on your mind.
Yeah, hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Really, I just think all the candidates aren't talking about the one most important issue, which is term limits on Congress members. We need massive overhauls and tough decisions that are going to be unpopular in some areas in this country. And as long as we have self-serving politicians who are always seeking re-election, they will always need to make the popular choice for their constituents.
So, Eric,
that
do you think that's
problem.
So I want to push back on you a little bit on that. Just the last part of what you said, Eric. So are you saying that people who are seeking re-election are inherently self-serving for doing so?
No, what I'm saying is I think that's going to prevent, like, for instance, the Green New Deal. That is going to negatively impact a lot of people, but it's something that's necessary in order to save our country. So without having term limits where you can have congressmen serving for over 20 years, but they never
Oops, we
that they truly
Yeah, Eric, so you're cutting out, but actually that's the perfect time because we happen to have a congressperson who served for a very long time as one of our panelists, and I obviously feel like I'd like to give him a chance to respond to that.
Well, Eric, I never heard anybody say that about Ted Kennedy, who was in there for 40 years. I never heard anybody say the term limit should be applied. At least I shouldn't say that. Never heard anybody I agreed with. And the average
member—
there is
a distinction there.
Well, there are some people who wanted Ted Kennedy gone the day he was elected, but they were not people that I would agree with on a philosophical basis. The average member of the House of Representatives serves 8 years and has that average has been the same for about 50 years now. And so, yes, there are some people and there was long term. There is nothing wrong with having some people in the room who know how the system works and know what happened 20 years ago. Now, I know you don't like to hear that. You think that just because somebody new comes in from Mississippi that all of a sudden they're going to agree with you on the Green New Deal. I'm here to tell you that's not true. You're going to get somebody from Mississippi, new, old, young, tomorrow, next week, who doesn't agree with the new Green Deal, no matter whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, and that's not the issue. The issue is getting people out there to vote in primaries. I think Tom just mentioned it. He's 100% right. If I could paint the world differently, the one thing I would paint is pretty much require everybody to pick one and vote in a primary. Mm-hmm. Because then we get rid of some of these extremes that we've had on both ends. My fear is that the Democratic Party might go the same way the Republican Party went and nominate an extremist because many of our more moderate people tend not to vote in primaries. Mm-hmm. And it happened in the Republican Party. That's how they ended up with Donald Trump, because they couldn't find a way to coalesce around a Jeb Bush or a Kasich or somebody who I wouldn't agree with, but at least it is more within the norm. And they waited too long, and they ended up having Ted Cruz be the so-called moderate option to Donald Trump. And I hope it does. For me, that's my fear about the Democrats now, is that we don't do that.
So we're really short on time, and I do want to get one more call in. So quickly, Laura from Newton, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I think last night the candidates all went after each other and made it about Donald Trump. And also, the thing that really disappointed me was how much it was against Barack Obama, who was our most popular president. I thought the night before, Pete Buttigieg's message about making this about you, the voter, was what really resonated with me. But last night was a train wreck.
All right. That's a strong image. That's really clear in my head, Laura. Thanks for that. And to that point, so I want to start shifting gears to close this up now. And I really want to hear from each panelist. And I think my question, I'll start with you, Reverend Mariama, is in the next round, because there will be more, right? Mm-hmm. What should the conversation be about?
Yeah, so I think one of the key things for me, and I think that may align with some of the younger voters that we've heard from, is I see Donald Trump as a problem, but not the problem. I see him as a symptom of a much larger problem that we have. And from my perspective, when I look at the climate situation, I feel like we have a short period of time to figure out, you know, how we're going to survive as a species on this planet. So I think, yes, Donald Trump is a problem. Yes, I want him gone. And I don't think I have to choose between him being gone and actually setting us on the right path. And so I think I'm looking for a leader that is really talking about where we need to go as a country, given the situation that we're in globally and the danger that we face. I think if they can pull back and get to that bigger level, one, they don't necessarily need to spend a lot of time attacking other people. I don't even necessarily need to get them in here, all the weeds. I want to know what's the vision for where we're going.
All right, Tom Nichols, you're a never Trumper, and you have said, just please give me somebody I can actually vote for. So what do you need to hear in the next round of debates?
I don't need to hear anything. I've already said that unless it's Tulsi Gabbard, who I think is far too close to an enemy power in Russia and Syria, I'll vote for a ham sandwich if the Democrats nominate it. I'm actually a better Democrat than Democrats on this. I'm the kind of Democratic, you know, future Democratic voter you want. Just tell me who the Democrat is and I'm going to vote for them, because I disagree with the Reverend. I think Donald Trump is the issue, because 4 more years of this is a existential threat to our constitutional system of government. So you do have to choose, because the Democrats had better focus and better focus fast on winning the Electoral College in 8 to 10 states that are up for grabs. that nothing else matters. It doesn't matter. Donald Trump, there was an analysis recently said Donald Trump could actually win the Electoral College and lose the popular vote by 5 million votes. That is what he is aiming for. That is intentionally his campaign strategy at this point.
All right, let's get the last word. Sorry to interrupt you. Last word of the congressman. Go ahead.
I happen to agree with both. I would like to have the bigger discussion, but I also want to win. And honestly, if we nominate the wrong people, they will not be able to win the states that Tom's talking about. In my opinion, I may be wrong, and that's fine. If we nominate the people that I think, again, not wrong myself, but not the ones who can best win a final election, I want them to prove me wrong. I kind of agree, Tom. I'll probably be voting for a ham sandwich too, if necessary. but at the same time, I do think we're going to have to go through this a little bit longer. We're going to have a fewer number of people at the debate the next time, and it's going to take a little longer to get to the better, higher plane.
All right. That's former Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, thanks for being here again.
Good to be here.
And Tom Nichols, professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.